Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ben Marcus, whose latest novel is The Flame Alphabet. Earlier books are The Age of Wire and String and Notable American Women. The Flame Alphabet has been described as experimental fiction. However, it actually ties into a lot of books currently being written. I don't see it as experimental per se. And insofar as I know, Ben Marcus, you kind of question what exactly experimental means anyway.
It's hard to know. And I would just ask, what is experimental about this book? Or who's making these assignations? Is there a company somewhere? You send them your book and they determine whether it's experimental or not. I wrote it the way I felt it, the way I heard it. And to me, it doesn't seem to tell us much when we call it experimental. It doesn't add any information. And also, I think, unfortunately, that word is used in a slightly derogatory way sometimes as a kind of big warning sign. Stay away, experimental. Let's go through the associations. It's pretentious. It's unreadable. It's difficult. It's, let's say, self-serving or indulgent.
There's a discussion about 5 or 6 years ago that you put your 2 cents in on Jonathan Franzen's comments regarding experimental fiction.
Sure. I was writing about his critical remarks and not at all about his fiction, which I respect, but he was wondering if a certain kind of writing was sending a bad message to readers, that perhaps literature was not prepared to compete with mass entertainment such as television and movies. And I felt the need to say, look, it's an art form, and it's okay to let people explore it. They're entitled to their tiny audiences if that's what they get, but there's no harm in this. In fact, it's healthy. Young artists, old artists want to test things out, want to find a way to make this form their own. That was an important argument to me.
There are films like Tree of Life being made as well.
Sure. Now and then something comes along that does seem to try to invent its own approach, and it can suddenly resonate with people. And I did want this book to really resonate. It has this maybe a high-blown conceit that the speech of children is toxic. At the same time, though, to me, what was important was that it's a story of a family and the challenges of a family to stay together when something rather terrible happens. So there's a human side, which is not usually associated with experimental. I think that's another stereotype, is that experimental work won't make you feel anything. So I could never agree to a term that would suggest there's no feeling, because to me, writing is about somehow, just with language, creating feeling in the body of a reader. Very simply, just lodging it there through sentences. And is that experimental? I don't know.
What you say takes us right now to The Flame Alphabet, because you say writing is about sentences which create feeling, and The Flame Alphabet is a novel about sentences that are toxic.
That's right. It's a reversal of what I believe and what I feel, and that reversal was important to me early in the book. I thought of my main character, Samuel, the father whose daughter's speech is making him sick, and I thought, well, what could be taken away from him that matters more than anything in the world, and that would be his family, but then secondarily it would be his language. I have 2 kids. I can't imagine being separated from them. Alongside that, coming in, you know, maybe a distant second is language. I can't imagine being separated from my language, or even who I would be if I would be anyone. So those were some of the opening ideas that seemed impossible. They seemed unbearable. They seemed hard to imagine, and I think that's why I couldn't quite forget them. I couldn't let them go, and I wanted to use them as a seed for the book.
Well, the other seed that you mentioned in an interview is that in the last book, in Notable American Women, you have a father fall, and language kind of crushes him.
He's imprisoned in an underground container in his backyard, and his punishment is to have language piped in through a tube by a guy standing above, and the idea being that eventually this room fills with language because it's physical and it crushes him. So that is one of the other seeds, yes.
And in fact, there are caves in Flame Alphabet with sound going into the cave, so you're picking up on that and expanding that.
It seems, I find anyway, that I return to a lot of the same ideas. I think even from my first book, I was physicalizing language, making it a little poisonous, a little threatening. to try to interpret that, I tend to exaggerate something slightly that's already there and see if there's a story to it, maybe in the way a fairy tale might.
Ben Marcus, at the end of writing Notable American Women, you were kind of stuck, and apparently you tried different books before you finally settled. At what point did you make the transition from, boy, another idea that doesn't work, to, oh, I think I can work with this?
It took a couple of years. I wrote some short stories. I wrote essays, including the one you mentioned that was in Harper's. I allowed myself to think and to marinate and to wonder what kind of book I wanted to write. It. In some sense, you're getting married to this thing for a few years and you had better feel some, at least some initial romance. That took a little while to come up. I wanted to try something I hadn't tried. At the same time, I was aware that I seemed, no matter what, to return to a kind of core grab bag of ideas. So I thought if I changed the approach, in this case, I have a single narrator, Samuel, who's telling this story, so the language can't be as complicated as in my other books. And if I tried for a lot of momentum and a much more resolved plot, that was just something I hadn't done. So that was interesting to me, and that was what got me started.
At what point did you begin reading up on Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism?
Right after I started writing the book. I was 2 years late on my research. I majored in philosophy in college and took a lot of courses in religion, the philosophy of religion. It's always been important to me, just let's say as an amateur reader without any real specialized knowledge. And Kabbalah interested me a lot, not in its, let's say, popular manifestations, but in some of the more esoteric territories, namely that there's one guy who's holding the wisdom and you're not allowed to talk to him and he's not allowed to admit that he's got the wisdom, and his wife is kind of running interference in the front room, and it turns out he's been dead for 10 years and she might know the other guy that he whispered the secret to, and you got to go find that guy. The idea that real religious knowledge is being protected, it's not being shared. This idea that it has to be kept secret suggested a lot of story to me.
And also, you and investigating underground Jewish cults.
Yeah.
What you created here was the literalization of that idea.
That's right. I was researching a little bit what happened to Judaism when the waves of immigrants came over after World War II, as well as before, and the ways, let's say in the 60s and 70s, the very natural forking of worship styles evolved. And I was looking a little bit at Reform Judaism, which is a little bit more liberal, a lot more liberal, sort of severed from anything Orthodox. There's actually one manifestation in which someone wanted the basements of everybody's homes to be linked by tunnels so they could all sort of, I don't know, what do you do when your basement is linked by tunnels? Use your imagination. And that I actually found after I'd already had my characters kind of worshiping in this hut in the woods, listening to the rabbi's sermons come through this strange radio. So I often found I was ratifying an idea after the fact and trying to make it seem as plausible, as realistic as possible.
The radios themselves, they seem to come right out of a David Cronenberg film.
I've been hearing that a lot. That's a great compliment to me. Sam and Claire, the narrator and his wife, in order to listen to their rabbi, have to operate a radio, but the radio is frequently broken. They don't understand it. They can't get it to work that well, and even when it does work, it seems problematic. I like the idea of making the religious transaction itself, receiving word, hard. It's hard for them. It takes this sort of physical exertion. It takes mechanical know-how, as opposed to sitting in a pew or sitting in a synagogue and simply listening, which is passive. I don't know why I did that, but that seemed interesting to me.
But what it also does, again, coming back to the fact that words themselves become poisonous, their religion, the religion that they're practicing, that most people practice, which is based on words, is itself poisonous, even though it's supposed to be telling the truth. It's still poison.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really meeting obstacles in every place. Early in the book, they think they might find some solution to this language plague at their synagogue. But it turns out that, in fact, their whole enterprise of gathering religious knowledge is later called into question. Science fails in the book, then medicine fails, and religion looks like a natural source to go to for even just comfort. but it too, I think the source of it anyway, is called into question in the book.
Ben Marcus, part of the story concerns trying to find ways out of this dilemma, trying to create ways in which people can communicate without getting sick. Did you always have it in your mind that it would never be a problem for you to actually come up with why this illness happened? Did you ever try to think that through and realize that it was irrelevant?
I thought about it all the time. I was haunted by the question of whether or not I needed to explain this as well as possible, even though it felt fundamentally unexplainable, or try to defeat in the reader the need for an explanation. I was thinking maybe after the fact a little bit about Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It begins after an unspecified apocalypse. We get no information about what happened. And I think the notion there is that it doesn't actually make a story more dramatic when we have more information. Information might slow a story down. So I did write out more explanations. I did try to link everything and create a little more logic to it. In the end, I thought, though, that Sam, the narrator, is telling the story. He's enormously isolated. He's not a doctor. He's not a scientist. And in the end, his insights are the ones that he has. He doesn't have that, let's say, narrator's distant perspective with a lot of extra information. So I was hoping the reader wasn't going to be too bothered by the lack of basic exposition.
It also becomes easier for you in that you've already made the decision to make it first-person point of view, whereas if you had third-person, you might create more of a problem.
I would think so. Yeah, it would be a much, much different imperative, I think, if there was a third-person omniscient narrator. There'd be really no reason not to give that information away. On the other hand, I did try to create suggestions of a cause by this look back into religious history with a series of cautions about language. There's a villain in the book who, late in the book, says, "What was it that ever made us think we could consume as much language as we wanted to? Why did we ever think that this enormously powerful thing that we produce out of our bodies is something we can just consume without getting sick?" I got a little attracted to the idea that it's not too far out.
At one point, there's a history of language and the possible dangers in language. Did you make that up?
I did. I did. I thought that attributing some of those ideas to people like Plutarch or Schopenhauer would make them seem more true.
You could have used Wittgenstein as well, actually.
I know. He seemed a little obvious. I don't know. I thought I'd leave him out of it.
A lot of ideas are presented that got me thinking. One is communication itself language? In other words, there are characters who point to go into that room. Is that affecting them? And what about music? Is music language?
Music is an interesting question, and it doesn't really play much of a role in the book, but I thought about it quite a lot. What happens in the book is that the problem continues to evolve. At first it looks like it's just Jewish children, then it looks like it's just children who are actually producing something toxic from their bodies that is hard to ingest, but then it's all language, and children are seen to be immune. Because you later realize, well, perhaps we are born with a kind of comprehension quota. There's only so much we can understand, so much we can perceive in terms of language. So I wanted the disorder to evolve the way a disease might, or the way a species or an entity might. I wanted it not to be fixed. And to me, the natural conclusion to that was that comprehension and understanding itself was something that we simply could only do so much. This links to this notion in Kabbalah, in Jewish mysticism, that understanding itself means you are failing to grasp, the depth of God. That if you find yourself understanding it, then you're wrong. Understanding is a sure sign that you're wrong. So I love the paradox of that insight itself is a sort of a decoy. It's a trick that you need to stay in a state of uncertainty or of bafflement. So that's a long answer to this question of what constitutes a language, because what ends up happening is that people can't communicate at all, and they can't understand even anything, and that these acts, let's say, in the brain are the problem.
You're listening to an interview with Ben Marcus, whose latest novel is The Flame Alphabet. Why Jewish children?
The narrator and his wife practice this odd cultish form of Judaism. They're called Forest Jews, and they're not allowed to talk about their worship style. So they become the subject of some suspicion and some scrutiny. And the villain in the book, Murphy, having exhausted scientific solutions, feels that perhaps the last secret being kept in the culture is what is going on in these huts and what are the rabbis saying. He wants to sort of flush these people out. And so he blames the Jews, which of course has terrible historical echoes. And of course then he turns out to be wrong. But I liked the notion of what would happen when something's being kept secret and what that makes people do in desperate times. Murphy is the sort of person he's made a series of moral choices that put him at some distance from, let's say, most of us. But on the other hand, it's not hard to understand why he's doing what he's doing. And he has a lot of sort of evil rationales that I found a little seductive and a little bit unpleasant at the same time.
As the language becomes more and more toxic, he becomes more and more slippery.
Yeah. I felt interested in doing some identity swaps, having people not be who they seem to be. That seemed to replenish the book a little bit and help me connect some points in the plot.
Ben Marcus, what this all does is it's all about language, and this is what writing is about. When you're talking with your students, because you teach writing, how much of what you write, how much of your own thoughts about the nature of language and writing go into that, or are you just trying to let the writers find their voices, even if the voices are very different from the kind of voices that you're looking for?
The latter. It would be a failure to me to try to get anybody, student or not, to write or even think the way I do. I think that what seems most productive in the classroom is to wonder for each individual writer what it is they dream of for a story to be and to give them some context. Sometimes students are writing in a tradition that they are writing in accidentally. They haven't done any reading in that. They don't even know that they're influenced by, let's say, Alice Munro, whose style is now pervasive and compelling and captivating to a number of younger writers. And so I think it's sometimes my job to fortify their practice, help them read and really think through what they're doing, and also to raise their standards for themselves so that they can become productively critical, not too easily pleased with what they're doing, harder on themselves while staying productive. My own work and my own ideas, I'm sure I can't put up a perfect firewall against them, but I'm not interested in disciples and I'm not interested really in proselytizing. I'm interested in helping students find their own thing that they can be equally excited about.
So to you, it doesn't really matter if they're writing in an ornate style or as Raymond Carver.
It doesn't, and I also don't think if you make it your job to try to change them, anyone's going to be happy. I don't think somebody's writing style is a sort of arbitrary thing, like the kind of clothing they wear. They just put on this shirt one day and they can try another shirt. I think it's reflecting a fairly deep set of instincts and urges and desires. It may lack technical facility. It might need polish, but I don't want to step in and try to change their actual vision. If, though, they're writing something that seems very unambitious and that is not entertaining anyone and seems flat and dead on the page, I do try to ask some questions about whether they feel their vision is enough. But I don't think it works to be too prescriptive in that sense.
Ben Marcus, an interesting quote from you in one of the interviews I've read earlier today: the novel is the king of bad dreams.
I said that.
It struck me that, along with being a kind of David Cronenberg riff in parts of Flame Alphabet, it struck me that a lot of the formulations in the book seemed very nightmarish, very dreamlike, in the way that we actually dream, not in the kind of idea of a nightmarish image.
I think that has been one way I've tried to retrospectively understand the book. It has some of the shadings of a nightmare. And I think about bad dreams a little bit. My daughter's 7, and she'll have the occasional bad dream, and we'll talk about it in the morning or in the middle of the night. And she was wondering why we have them. You know, we sort of understand why we have good dreams and the kind of purging effect that they have and how important they are. Bad dreams must have a biological purpose, a psychological purpose, and in some sense they're kind of thrilling when we wake up and they're so vivid, they're so compelling, they're so convincing. In mine, whatever bad has happened is so final and so convincing and irrevocable that when I wake up I have this adrenaline surge of relief that it's not real. And I think I'm attracted to the idea that we can produce these experiences in some sense, not just to appreciate that they're not real, to indulge in the worst only to know that that won't happen to us, but to, I think, test out the possibilities of our world, to wonder the worst and to see what we might be like in certain circumstances. I think it satisfies a facet of our curiosity.
One thing I did notice in reading these interviews, that Flame Alphabet was written in a different way than your earlier works, where each sentence was polished, whereas this one you had to go back and polish. And I wonder if that has something to do that in the longer form, where you're just trying to get stuff down on paper, you're drawing more initially from the unconscious rather than consciously trying to mold.
It's a good question. I very deliberately tried to write faster than in the past, and I used sentences and language that I might not normally use that were simply functional. He got out of his chair and left the room. That would be the sort of sentence that in the past I would feel needed a big microscope and lots of salting and lots of difference. And sometimes these very simple utilitarian sentences are a relief, and they create a little bit of speed and a little bit of a kind of downtime for us when we read, so we're not constantly having to decode and decipher and understand. I maybe discovered that they have their real purpose in a story that needs to have momentum.
Well, you're also stuck with a problem which happens in any book where there's very little dialogue, because you can't glide past like you can with dialogue. We tend to read dialogue faster, but you've created poison dialogue, so as the book continues, there's going to be less and less of it.
It's terrible, I know. Well, then I did invent a kind of serum so people could talk to each other again.
I don't even want to get into that serum. That came from a place I don't even want. That's a part of Ben Marcus I really don't want to know. Seriously, as you're moving into those darker places, you're uncovering things that must have been disturbing to your wife and kids.
Yeah, I think so. My kids are not old enough to read this book, and it's dedicated to them as it is to my wife. But I think that the moral complexity of the situation was what interested me, not the sort of heroic glossed over side. I could have written a story where a knight in shining armor comes and fixes things, but each development seemed somehow to arise out of the development before it. And maybe this is connected to the logic of dreams, the logic of nightmares, that the progressions felt, to me anyway, to build on what had just happened. As children, being the only immune people to this situation, would then naturally be a source of some curiosity, some scientific curiosity. What is it that they have or don't have that is protecting them? So that felt somehow to be a natural evolution.
What about the idea that it is a post-apocalyptic novel? I mean, that's pretty much set out in the opening paragraphs of the book. Was that always in the back of your mind? And, you know, at that point, were you directly drawing from someone like McCarthy, Cormac McCarthy?
The conceit of the book, that there would be a poisonous language, then demanded a kind of a setting or a kind of a set of social circumstances that instantly would put it in the post-apocalyptic category. It would be interesting to me to wonder if I could have written this as a domestic realist tale in our time without it still being seen as a post-apocalyptic. So I tried through setting and some other details to make it feel as much to be in our world as possible, because I think that the idea itself requires some suspension of disbelief, so that if I was adding many layers of, let's say, futuristic stuff, it just wouldn't have worked to me. I guess it's post-apocalyptic because it's about something bad that happens, and it's not happening right now. So it's a fairly big category.
Well, Ben Marcus, having written a more narrative book, do you see yourself working more in this direction or going back to the kind of writing that you were doing before?
After I finished this book, which is now about 18 months ago, I fairly quickly wrote a bunch of short stories, some of which are complete domestic realism, others of which I think are a little bit more like the world of the Flame Alphabet. I feel that having written this book, I learned quite a bit. We have a lot more to learn about storytelling and about momentum and about suspense, and I'm interested to have those things in my toolkit. I am finishing a story collection right now. I'm doing the final edits, and it has stories that are really across the range of those approaches from my earlier books to this book, as well as some newer work that I think is even more narrative and, let's say, less overtly strange. I think I like not knowing where I want to land on this or possibly even pushing the continuum more. I wonder what would happen if I tried to really restrict things and write a very, very straight narrative story, you know, about flowers and teacups and a calm conversation in the garden between two people who like each other. I don't know. I think about these things because I think about taking away some crutches. And sometimes I have crutches that are productive for me. In this case, language is a physical substance and it will make you sick. If I wrote something with no conceit at all other than human beings in a parlor room who are maybe not so happy with each other, what would I do? How would I approach it? I'm interested in those challenges, and I fantasize about shedding my skin a little and trying something that really looks different, but I also know we can't quite do that. We will still look like ourselves as writers.
Then again, look at someone like John Banville, and you see that bifurcation. You know, for me, his non-John Banville books are more fun to read, and I like them better, but it's still John Banville.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know. I will be starting a novel in the next few months, and I think it's really about finding something that I can't let go of, that I can't forget, that I can't stop thinking about, and then trying to figure out the tools to make it alive for a reader.
Are you finding the same problems coming into the novel that you found coming into the Flame Alphabet, where you're just going around hitting dead ends before something finally clicks?
I've not even started, so no. Oh. I've started to think about it just in my head, but I'm finishing a story collection, so I've written a couple sort of sketchy little things, but I've been focusing on the Flame Alphabet coming out and getting the story collection done, so I don't feel that sense of stress or difficulty yet with the novel that I've barely even begun to think about.
Well, one thing about the Flame Alphabet is that it's very visual. A lot of visceral images come up, again, like a movie. Have you thought about doing screenplays?
I have not really. I probably might do that at some point if I got interested in something and it would seem to be the best form for it. I love films, and it would be really fun, really interesting to try to do one sometime, but I don't have any immediate plans.
In one of your interviews, you talked about how you didn't like flashbacks. You were talking about your short stories, and yet Flame Alphabet is filled with flashbacks.
It might be why I said that. I begin this book with the scene of the parents leaving their daughter, but then I have to loop back to quite a lot of background that leads up to this moment. And if I have a criticism of this book, it's that I take too long. And I could have written it straight. I could have written at the beginning of the problem, the middle of the problem, and then the departure.
But, one of the things I know is that your job is also to get the reader into the book. And you can't start at the beginning.
Well, it's an interesting question. Because right when I finished this, all I wanted to do was write something that was beginning, middle, end, a straight timeline. I felt that this was really a corrective urge because I felt a little bit manhandled by my timeline in this book. Even though it's a lot straighter than any timeline I had yet written, it has its delays, and I think a lot about this, and so I don't know that I couldn't have just done it from the beginning.
Getting back to the cinematic idea would be to do what you did here. We're in the story, and then we find out.
That's good, then. I do know it is a recognizable approach. You give a present moment that's rather urgent and scary but hard to understand. You step back and you show the slow build back up to that. And not only do you get back to that present moment, but you've also learned a lot more. And that present moment is itself transformed from what you've learned. Now, I don't know. I like in a short story to try to move on a straight timeline, but I think if I do that one or two more times, I might turn on that as well, or I hope. I think it seems productive to interrogate these things that suddenly matter to you and then try to turn them on their heads.
Did you ever read a book called Lost in the Funhouse by John Barth?
Sure. I read that in college, and Barth was somebody along with Robert Coover, Donald Barthelme, William Gass, people who felt that they had inherited a certain kind of traditional, straightforward approach to the novel, and they wanted to tear it apart and eat the corpse. And some of that looks cerebral and academic, but a lot of it was really vigorous and interesting, and it showed a writer really kind of tearing open his toolkit and wondering about all these objects and what they could be for. That Barth book is great.
Ben Marcus, one other element of Flame Alphabet that kept coming back to me was the political element. You don't really allude to politics at all in the book. However, in watching the Republican Party at work, we can kind of see the poison of language. Was that ever in the back of your mind?
It must be. I'm not immune to the ways in which in our culture we debase language. It's strange to be a writer because you're using a medium that everybody uses. And a lot of people think that they could be a writer. And we use it, though, for a lot of unnecessarily superficial exchanges, just to go buy food or to exchange basic information. So I'm interested in that in a way, but I feel more interested in what happens if you try to use language in a way that has no actual practical application. And that is, in other words, literature. So I see it debased all the time, but I don't know that I get a lot of insight out of it so much as feeling the need to undebase it and to use it in ways that matter to me. And also to show that language is just the most fascinating thing that we have, and it has, if you put it in certain combinations, it can make us feel things we haven't felt before.
Many years ago when I was in grad school, we studied the work of a philosopher named Suzanne Langer who talked about the relationship. Feeling and form. And you talk a lot about how you're trying to generate feeling in a narrative. Her perspective was that a narrative has to be the lowest form because it's all form, whereas music is the highest because it's all feeling. What do you think about that?
I have to think she's wrong because I'm not a musician. I don't have the luxury of admitting defeat there. And I also know that from when I was first reading, books were the biggest tool I could find to help me feel things I hadn't felt. I could get lost in a book and just be transformed and really emotionally changed. And so I understand her concept about the form, but I also think, and I feel this reading poetry, reading, let's say, more avant-garde fiction, that there are things we don't know yet about what the language can do. It's not an exhausted medium. We've found very, very efficient, effective ways at entertaining each other with language. Jane Austen found an amazing way to write a novel, and a lot of people today think that was it. That it can't get any better than that, really. We'll change the characters and give them beards and change their genders and upgrade their clothing and their dramatic situation, but the basic approach to narrative was perfected by Jane Austen. I love Jane Austen. I love reading contemporary people who write just like Jane Austen, but I'm also, I think, maybe foolishly curious about what new can happen with this medium.
Well, I objected way back when because it found to me that, arguing against the nature of representative art as opposed to abstract art struck me as, well, then and now as kind of bizarre, simply because, as you, I got most of my feeling from reading, novels.
Sure. But I think this is, in literature anyway, it's a very contested ground. Because literature, at least let's say some in the industry, would like to compare it to television and movies, and it's it's a distant, distant third in terms of, let's say, revenue and reach and all of that. And there's some finger wagging about this, and it's understandable that some people would like to, you know, try to make it as broad and as accessible as possible. And it's important that they're doing that. But it's equally important to me that there are people for whom that approach is just not native. It's just not natural, not instinctual. And they have these different artistic instincts, and they want to chase them down and see what will happen.
Ben Marcus, now that you've completed this and you're beginning to go around the edges of your next novel, do you plan to do more essays?
I don't know. I don't feel that I can. They take me, you know, 4 months to write, and then I just regret them. So I like to review books now and then. I'm reviewing something now, and maybe I'll do another review in the summer. I'm a little slow, and I've got a job and a family, and so I think that I usually feel it's smart to save my time for fiction and let the essayists be the essayists.
You've been listening to an interview with Ben Marcus, whose latest novel is The Flame Alphabet. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.